Well, hello. It's the nose. It's the end of the week. It's time to talk about culture. There's no Kyan Wolf around today. It's one of these sort of slightly empty days in the studio, filled with joy, but not as many bodies around. And so we can't play you a comic intro. We can't even play you the music from Dunkirk, which is the first thing we'll be talking about today, because it would frighten and upset you. It would ratchet up your anxiety level and... you would say, what's wrong? Something is about to happen. Something really bad is about to happen because you have that music. Let me tell you who's here, and then I'll tell you what we're talking about. Teresa Kramer is a writer and editor of eContent Magazine and the founding editor of The Cut, not to be confused with The Cut in New York Magazine. This is The Cut about Connecticut and grumpy people of a certain age. James Hanley is co-founder of Cine Studio at Trinity College. Kate Russian is teaching artist for the Connecticut Office of the Arts and a Pushcart-nominated poet. We'll be talking a little bit later about a controversy that has arisen about a piece of culture which is, like, I mean, nothing has happened. It is like there's no preliminary shooting. There's nothing has been done, and yet there are people who are really upset about this thing. That's the world we live in these days. And we'll also talk about a magazine profile. It is the profile. I guess I can say this now. It's so radioactive that it's you. If you talk about it, you get people upset. It's the cover story in a New York Magazine. It is a profile of Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough and Donald Trump and the peculiar love triangle that they represent. And I got yelled at it. I get yelled at in my house for having the magazine quietly in my hands in bed reading that article. I wasn't reading it out loud, and I yelled at just as a thought crime, basically, for having to. But first, we're going to talk about Dunkirk. Dunkirk, obviously, is the new movie directed by Christopher Nolan. It is probably first and foremost a Christopher Nolan movie, and everything else second, although we can debate that. It, of course, takes place in the early stages of World War II, when enormous numbers of British and French troops are surrounded by the British in a tiny coastal town. And spoiler, I mean, you should know this anyway. But miraculously, a huge number of them, essentially 10 times as many as Winston Churchill thought was possible, were evacuated, partly because of a flotilla of 700 local English boat owners who, like little boats that came across the channel and helped out. So that's the story. I don't even know that that's exactly the story of this movie. It's one of the things that we're going to have to thrash out here. So I don't know where to begin exactly. James, I'm sure you have so much to say about this, but before we get into the technique, or maybe this is a way into the technique, I don't know. I just got off the phone with Bill Curry, who referred to this as the inside Llewyn Davis of military epic movies. And I know what he means, too, right? Which is that, this is this incredibly epic story, but it is essentially told through three very specific individual mm-hmm. perspectives, right? Rather than going for a David Lean kind of sweep, this movie goes for something else. What's the something else, though?
Well, I think it's a quintessentially internal movie in a way. One of the things you mentioned, actually, is kind of interesting about mentioning Christopher Nolan. I think Christopher Nolan as a director actually is increasingly sort of submerging behind what he's creating. And I mean by that I found Dunkirk to be a sort of immersive experience that once it began, it just didn't stop until the end. It didn't have a sort of standard narrative. It used sound and picture in ways that are almost surrealistic in a way that sort of, to me, drew me in and became so absorbing that I felt I experienced something about war that was really different. It made me think about the ordinariness of people who get caught up in something that happens that they didn't control. And I'm thinking now of what we face now with the danger of an unstable person leading our country who I have this horrible fear that something could go wrong very quickly. And this film made me think about that. And I thought that really there's so much history about World War II, and you can read about Dunkirk and you can think about the things that seem to happen, and it is really complex in a way, all of the various events, the driving of the army, the British army toward the shore, and this was a major defeat, really. And it meant that there was a real sort of sense that the possibility of winning the war for the British was actually distant. This was a real threat. And I thought this movie really got to the heart of what that feeling was like. It's some of the images in it, like soldiers lining up single file, waiting at the waves, for example, was an incredibly eloquent statement of, like, why are they all lined up?
Well, waiting. It has been suggested that that's some of the Britishness of this movie.
Yes, well, definitely so. But so many elements like that there were, and the fact that instead of showing you a massive air battle, the air battles that took place were focused on just a small number of planes, and the very visceral nature of the people who were involved, the pilots who were involved, and the soldiers on the boats, and the threat of the bombs falling and being attacked by planes coming in and strafing the beach. All of those things, I just think it's a different thing. I think Christopher Nolan is an incredible talent, has an incredible talent for doing that. But it's sort of paradoxical that it's almost not about him. He's created something that is really focused away from him and his skills as a director, and more on a sort of immersive experience that takes you somewhere completely new, like seeing a piece of art or reading a book that really explains something and enlightens you in a different way.
See, I knew he'd have a lot to say about this. So, but Kate, I do think in that whole idea of the ordinariness of this, you know, I mean, we're many war movies that we grew up watching, if we watch them at all, were about heroes and heroic people. And, you know, I mean, really the young man who's the initial focus of this movie, we don't really even know his name. Apparently is Tommy in the credits. I don't know that that name is ever said anywhere. Our first two encounters of him with him over a short period of time mostly involve him trying to go poop. he tries to go poop in a village, and that doesn't work out so well because he gets shot at, and so he runs out into the beach and then finds another place to go poop. Well, that you can't be more ordinary than that. You can't be more dragged down than that. And I don't know. I mean, I do agree with James that, and this is not a spoiler, but there's like one scene where there's just a series of explosions on the beach in a line, and they just stop before they blow up one particular person. And you just sort of think, well, that wasn't because that particular person was like really nice or special or anything like that, right?
Yeah, you know, I think the movie really communicates the randomness of horrible death throughout the film. And as I was watching it, I was very engaged by the movie. I was engaged by the soundtrack and the fact that there was not much dialogue. There wasn't any dialogue at the beginning of the film. And I was very engaged by what you referred to, James, as a kind of a surrealistic view of war. But ultimately, I came to see the film as being very flat. Although I was very relieved that it was, although it was full of death, it was not full of blood and gore. And I came to think that the movie was really a merging of comics and a video game, especially from the beginning, where we get the perspective of the young, handsome protagonist who's just scrambling to save his life. And I asked myself, well, who is this for? And then I thought about the rating. It's PG-13. I said, well, this is a PG-13 war movie. And I think it's very ironic that Nolan has said several times that it's not a war movie. Right. And so then my question is, then what is it if it's not a war
movie?
He
says it's a survival movie, right?
Yeah. It's a survival movie, but I saw it as a movie about the heroes of this movie are the civilians for the most part, right? Like most of the sort of army infantry are just sitting there waiting to die for most of this movie. They're just sitting ducks. And it's sort of one of the, it almost read to me like one of those old-timey like British propaganda movies about like the pluck of the British people. And that was really how it read to me. I just thought this is a movie, and And so my grandmother grew up in England during World War II, and so I've heard all the tales of these sorts of things. And so that was what I was thinking about for the entire movie. I just kept thinking, oh, Nana was getting bombed around this time, you know? Mm. Like, so that was what came across to me.
By planes, we should say.
Yes, by planes. She was probably also getting bombed, let's be real. Yeah.
Well, I have so many things I want to ask you guys about. So one thing about this, James, all right, so we are dealing with one of the real key points of British mythos, you know? I mean, this is an incredible story for England. Although it's a story which, I forget who pointed this out, but that other countries might not make that big a story out of. It's essentially a story of colossal defeat.
Yes, exactly.
And a very impressive retreat in the face of colossal defeat. But it really means something very specific to the British. Now, I do feel as though I thought everything that you said was just a brilliant description of what Nolan does. I think you could argue that it costs him certain things. And certainly the flotilla we know involved about 700 boats. It seems like a very small thing in this movie that, I mean, I know he's not David Lean. He's not going to do some huge sweeping shot with all these fluttering banners from these little boats and stuff like that. But I don't know. I wanted a little bit more somehow, you know, of what we think of anyway as that kind of movie.
Well, I think that his style of movie making is to play hard to get to begin with, right from Memento, that it's challenging the audience to pick out what's going on and to have some sort of sense of, like in the Batman movies, it's the psychology, the distorted psychology of the character that you have to sort of draw out, and it appears to be a superhero movie, but then it turns out to be a story of psychological turmoil, really, and the characters who are sort of spinning around it. One of the fascinating things to me about that approach is that it's like the content of what he's trying to get across is really what he's really focusing on, and he's not turning the movie. For instance, I thought what you said, Kate, about the movie being flat, I think it's actually flat for a reason in that, number one, it is about a defeat, but it's also about a rescue. But it's a rescue from a horrible situation of these soldiers who were stranded. Yet what lies on the horizon is actually the possibility that England might get invaded. And it was quite likely, in fact. And many people felt that the enormous might of the army, the German army, was ready to do just that. And the movie doesn't have a start and a finish and a climax. And at the end of it, I felt it was kind of like when you've seen a stirring piece of music or heard a stirring recitation of some kind that it's like you let your breath out. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of the tension is lost at that point, and you're feeling your body in a different place, and your head is like trying to make sense of it. But I don't think that I think that that's what is really thrilling to me about this movie, actually, that it doesn't pander to the audience. It's really trying to say something a little different, which is to tell a story in a relatively simple, visceral way that doesn't involve the sort of, you know, massive flotilla of these small boats. But it does touch on the nature of the British myth, or not myth, actually, in some ways it's very true, about ordinary people who wanted to do something and they jumped in their boats. And in fact, some of them, like Mark Rylance's character, jump in the boat before the military get to him to tell him to do this. And this is something that is very fundamental about, you know, the idea of what was going on in World War II and how people were being, how you had all of these young people who were coming to war, who were coming from this disastrous defeat in war. And the question was, what was next? And you have this feeling of apprehension about it. And all of that, to me, gave it a reality that was totally different.
I have a whole bunch of other things I want to talk about with that. But I want to go back to a little bit to technique, Kate. One of the things that clearly Nolan wants us to do is lose track of time. And He at the beginning of this movie, he does a thing that no director's ever done, which is he kind of presents the equivalent of a legend on a map. He says the mole, which is the name of this pier that they're all trying to use to get their boats. The mole equals 1 week, and then you're told that the sea equals 1 day, and that the air equals 1 hour. And it didn't quite sink in with me what he was telling me.
Yeah.
But what he's telling you is that he is about to tell you three different narratives with three different sets of characters, and he is going to interleave those narratives. But they're not simultaneous. And in fact, between that and this very disorienting Hans Zimmer score, which is like these weird tones that kind of rise and never quite resolve themselves, Tim Cohn, our intern, said it's like a barber's pole. It's kind of like seems to be moving up and down at the same time. I had kind of a time loss. I had no idea how long the movie was when I walked out of it.
Yeah, I agree with you that I didn't really have a sense of time either. But Nolan really did build up this tension and suspense, and he did these quick cuts within the land, sea, and air dramas, and then he shifted from one to the other very quickly, combined with the Zimmer music. It does create this tension, but again, my question is, like, to what end, to what purpose? And going back to what Colin was saying, the point he brought up about the hero, if you think about the hero's journey that involves a change, the only character that really changes is the son. And he's the only one who returns home to take back something new that he's won or gained from the experience. And I have to say that I found the absence of women and the absence of the colonial units within the evacuation to be.
There has been a little criticism of that the Indian army is not shown there,
and the Senegalese units and the units from Chad and other and North Africa as well.
I don't know, Teresa, do you want to just quickly react to that, or I have a whole other direction I don't want to go?
Sure. Well, Kate and I talked about it a little downstairs. I didn't have the same reaction to women. I've read the same criticisms about the colonial armies. There were women on some of the boats that get sunk. You know, they're nurses. Mm-hmm. They're part of the there were even women on some of those civilian boats, actually, when they arrived. There's a lady who was sort of jauntily dressed
right.
for a day day at sea. And, you know, so I think we talked about where would you fit in more women? And Kate's idea was sort of at the homecoming. But that doesn't feel, to me, that feels just tacked on. That doesn't feel, it doesn't feel needed. We see women dying on boats, you know, trying to save these guys from the beach.
Yeah, not exactly. We don't exactly see them dying. We know they're there.
Well, we don't really see anyone dying.
Yeah.
The one thing that I will say is that I think that one of the things that he's trying to do is to create a pretty small universe to work in. So there are these three basic stories. One of them is the story that's taking place on the beach, and it involves a number of protagonists. We can say a little bit about who they are. There's this other story at sea. That's Mark Rylance, the fabulous British actor who plays just a guy who owns what looks like a pretty nice pleasure boat. And he takes off with his sweater vest and his tie, which he never removes the entire time, and does what he can to help along with his son and another boy. And then the last one takes place in the air. There's some rule in movies that because Tom Hardy is too beautiful, you have to put a mask over his face. So he is this Spitfire ace. This is at least three times, right? It's in the Mad Max movie, and then he's Bane in the Batman movies.
Yeah,
and it's like you have to cover Tom Hardy's face.
I did see that. I actually saw it mentioned before the movie, but just didn't register they were talking about Dunkirk. So then at the end, when he finally takes off his mask, I was like, oh, that's Tom Hardy. And that's that thing I read.
Yeah.
But I have to feel that Tom Hardy is complicit with this, this has become part of his shtick.
Yeah. You want to see my beauty, you have to pay extra.
Right.
Well,
so,
with that last scene with him kind of posing and looking out before he's captured
right.
by
no,
the
not too many spoilers,
German.
Not too many spoilers.
Oh, you can't spoil a comics, Colin, really. Come on now.
Not too many spoilers here. although I'm debating there's the thing that I wanted to talk about. I'm trying to think of a way to talk about it without doing a spoiler. But what I was saying was this kind of small universe notion that you don't really see until the very end of the movie. You don't see a German. And even then, you really don't see a German. You don't see a German. You know, I don't think you hear the word German mentioned. Maybe it's once or twice. You might hear the word Nazi somewhere. But really, this is – there's a way in which this is kind of abstracted a little bit from context. These are people who – in a way, they could almost be in Syria or some other horrible place. You know, this isn't quite so much about the specific geopolitics of that moment. You're not shown the enemy. You're not shown much discussion. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's kind of maybe as ethnically confined as it is, too. It is this little abstracted moment. And you know, somebody just tweeted and said, is this in some ways a Brexit movie? Being British is very in vogue in Britain among Brexiteers, this person tweets. And I sort of think, how can I do this without spoiling it?
You can't spoil anything, Colin. Go ahead.
There's a moment near the end where a certain character, who's a very famous person in the iconography of Britain, says that he's not leaving Dunkirk because he has to help the French too. And to me, that's the anti-Brexit statement, right? That's the statement where this isn't really a movie about geopolitics. It's a movie about survival in a really terrible war situation. And it is, as James said, this very immersive experience where I think, you know, they're trying to show you what that's like. But to the extent that it is about it, it is like that one line from Branagh, I think, is the kind of the anti-Brexit line.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I think that's strongly so. I mean, there's a strong element of sort of the shared experience and the whole nature of actually getting across the divide between people who are actually in a war situation and people who are not. And I think that there's also the very nature of Christopher Nolan's directing style is ellipsis and using allegory and sort of teasing you with things that might be true and might not be true, timeline distortions. I mean, this film, it's really kind of like there's a reflection of his earlier film Memento in that introduction at the beginning with a sort of puzzling sort of thing. At first, you don't realize that what those texts at the beginning mean, and then it comes into it. And I think within that sort of world of allegory, I mean, I've always felt that, you know, particularly British war movies ignored the participation of colonial peoples who'd been dominated and conscripted basically to fight the wars. And that's a great shortcoming in many films that have been highly praised. I do sort of think in this particular film, I wouldn't say it's forgivable. I think they could have done something about that. But the movie is really not about reality of that. At that level, I don't think. And so to a certain extent, I forgive it that, and I don't forgive many other films for it. The problem I'm getting at, I guess, is that films and film directors who portray their work as being, this is my view of the reality. And therefore, you know, you then, implicit in that is that you should get the facts right. I'm not sure in this film in Dunkirk that there are any facts per se. That it's not dealing with facts, it's dealing with experience, it's dealing with what happened here, and it's also dealing with the idea of being defeated and being, at the end of the film, not winning anything.
There's also this
other than surviving.
There's also this idea so much, they're constantly saying, I can practically see home, right? It's right there.
Yeah.
And if you're a Senegalese troop, that's not true for you. So if this is a movie about people just trying to get home, and you then throw in like Indian troops who they're going to England, they're not going home. It sort of throws off that part of the narrative a little bit, because so much of that for me, I kept thinking about the Great British Baking Show, because one of my favorite things about that show is that they just stopped to drink tea in the middle of the competition all the time, and I just kept thinking that all these people were just going to get home and start drinking.
Well,
tea.
Well, I mean, even in the movie, there is no situation so dire in this movie, and there are a lot of very dire situations that you are not 10 minutes away from a cup of tea.
Well, actually, at one point, the father on the boat actually is serving tea.
Right. Go ahead.
But if I could just say, respond a bit to what James was saying. I understand what you're saying about reality, but movies also create these huge myths in our minds.
I agree.
And yeah. I think that the myth that there weren't African peoples and Indian peoples and West Indians living in France and Britain during this time and before.
And conscripted into war.
And conscripted yeah. is, and that they weren't citizens also, is to me, it's parallel to our American belief that all the cowboys were white,
right.
which
well,
they
also,
weren't.
Also,
and one in four was black.
Yes, and also the truth about slavery and yeah. money and all of those things. I agree; those things really do. They our filmmaking, our art generally has not dealt with some really visceral, serious issues that you know I can't. It's. What I guess I'm saying about this is that Christopher Nolan is really a surrealist artist in this context, and I don't think anything about the film is linked directly to fact. But we do absolutely need to tell stories better.
And actually, that's a nice segue into the next thing that we're going to be talking about, too, which is this proposed way of telling a story like that on HBO. So we should probably go to a break here because we're running out of time. I will say just quickly that, grant everything that you just said, I still think this is a movie's an important step up in the sense that we're seeing people saved from world domination by someone other than Thor and Iron Man. You know, that's typically what we've been watching in movie theaters for the last 2 years. So, you know, at least we're kind of crawling into reality a little bit. I show Oh, there's never enough time. We didn't get to talk about all the different IMAX configurations. And James went to a place in Providence where when you watch Dunkirk, you can actually get wounded. It's like their equipment's that good.
It's the one theater where they put the old-style tall IMAX screen, which is totally enveloping,
right.
Really amazing.
And, of course, this thing was shot on film. It can be shown in 70 millimeter, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, we had to skip that. But if you want to know where to go to completely, you know, you actually have a small abrasion from shrapnel, James will tell you how to get there. All right. So we were talking towards the end of the last segment about, you know, how do you make some of these important and tragic consequences of history come alive in when you transfer them to the world of either – in historical drama or non-historical drama. Well, I think that's a not too awkward segue into a weird controversy that popped up in the last week or two over HBO's plans for a project called Confederate. You must have heard about it by now, even though it's nowhere close to being anywhere where you could see it. I mean, in fact, it's not clear that pen has been put to paper very much on this. One of the reasons it's of interest is that the two great Game of Thrones creators, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, are behind it. It would be set in a world where slavery still exists, an alternative timeline where the Southern states still seceded from the Union and kept slavery. It has been denounced. We should say, so I don't have to sort of spring it back, that there are two African-American creators involved here, Nichelle Tremble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman, who feel as though that they've got something to say with this project. But it's already been denounced, and it's been attacked as slavery fan fiction, among other things. Well, I don't know. Kate, I mean, I think you and I had the same initial reaction. I remember being at a theater where there was a bunch of Christians protesting Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. And I was there to cover it as a newspaper person. And I said, well, have you seen the movie? Well, what is it you don't like? And they said, oh, no, we're not seeing this movie. and that's sort of the initial problem here. Like, what is it that people are in such a lather about? And how can they know?
Yeah, I believe in seeing the movie. I believe in reading the book and then taking it from there. At the same time, I do have to ask myself why this scenario now, especially in the current political and social situation we find ourselves in. And I guess, you know, I would like to see it, but I do have to ask, well, why this movie now? You know, is this, what, like a response to Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation? But I my mind goes to Kindred by Octavia Butler, which is a fantasy about an African-American woman being snatched back into slavery through time travel, and she has to make some decisions about it. And I again, I have to think back to the conversation that James and I were having about Dunkirk and mythology. I think it's important the way we represent the past and the way we represent the future, and who are we leaving out of the past and who are we leaving out of the future.
But, you know, Teresa, as you pointed out in one of your emails, alternative history is having a moment right now anyway. I mean, it's always having a moment. And, I mean, the two most popular things, the most popular thing for many years is what if the Germans won the war? That's, of course, Philip Roth. And it's The Man in the High Castle. It's a lot of those things. And now, what if the outcome of the Civil War were slightly different is kind of having a moment, too. And there's some things that alternative history can do.
Right. I think this so as Kate's asking why this right now, the thing that keeps coming to mind for me are these sort of controversies we hear about textbooks that refer to slaves as workers or something ridiculous like that. And
workers.
Yes. And so I think
or movies and books like Gone with the Wind, where slavery is represented as an essentially benign force in life.
Exactly. And so I think but we're hearing about this right now being taught in school through textbooks. Right. And we're also having these fights over Confederate monuments in the South. And so I think this is a really good time to use the idea of alternative history to bring home the realities that maybe are not being taught properly in school. Or, you know, there are still people who just think, you know, they're just proud Southerners. These Confederate monuments are just about being proud Southerners. And there are plenty of arguments to be made to keep those monuments around, but they then have to be put in a larger context than a show like this can do that.
Yeah, James, what are your thoughts?
I think you make an excellent point, Teresa, about that. You really, I mean, in the midst of all sorts of disinformation, deliberate disinformation, and actually not addressing real issues, it is almost a sort of a rescue to see, okay, well, somebody who's a good writer, people who really have their hearts in telling the truth, can actually produce a story that is played on television or as a movie, and it actually has a positive effect. But I think it also reflects a very sad situation that we have to deal with that conversation through a fictional creation like that. I mean, I think that the time to have a discussion about the wealth that was created by slavery all over the world and the fact that that lies at the base of our massive commercial machine around the world, and that this massive commercial machine has now sort of taken over to such an extent that people's lives are really deleteriously affected by it, and we still cannot have that conversation about the nature of slavery and that slavery was something that produced a lot of wealth for people who are alive now and who are deciding things like what's going to happen with rights, who's going to vote, and stuff like that. And that, to me, is, I mean, that's a background to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, I appreciate the honesty of people who really want to tell this story, but is there no way to actually have more of a discussion that actually is based in reality and actually talks about the nature of, okay, what about an enormous bank that is based on the fortunes of slavery, mm-hmm. and that we haven't had that discussion. And just one last thing. One of the things that bothered me about this was it being called Confederate, not Confederacy, or like it's using the word Confederate. And there's a sort of subtle message about that, that this is somebody who's actually, you know, maybe doing the wrong thing, but is somehow admirable. I don't know if I'm alone in that, but it's like a creepy
sort
of feel.
I had a question about the title as well.
Although I think I would put that in the category of give it time. Let's see what it really is. Let's see why it's really called that. I do want to say, first of all, James, I feel like one thing doesn't preclude the other. I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates wants to write really serious books about reparations and stuff like that. He also wants to work on comic books. You know, true, yeah. And I think creators can do a lot of different things. I am a big exponent of alternative history stuff. And you know, I mean, everybody was blown away by Underground Railroad, but I was also blown away by Ben Winters' Underground Airlines, which has a very similar kind of plot. The notion is that there's still four states in a contemporary environment that have slavery. And not only do they have slavery, but they have runaway slaves and they have people who are sent out to get them. That's very much the plot of this. But, I mean, it does very much call attention to, just in the same way that I probably don't want to know who made this Fitbit that's on my wrist right now and what kind of working conditions that they had. Because it was probably in Asia and it was probably terrible. But, I mean, in this scenario, and presumably in the one that's in Confederate, those people are in Georgia. And they're slaves and they're making the stuff that you use. And I think that in a way slaps people in the face a little bit harder because it's something they could recognize. A thing that I could go to the store and buy could be made by American slaves. I think if you write that right and you present it right, it can have a lot of force to it. All right, I'll stop babbling. Anybody want to get a last word in a minute before we dive into the other
story? You stole my point. The thing I was thinking. You said earlier the thing about, you know, slaves in Georgia making something. And the first thing that popped into my head there was there are slaves in Bangladesh making something, you know, your Old Navy shorts or something like that right now. So, I mean, they may be getting paid something, but it's not fair working conditions. And people, we do not think about that as Americans. We just do not to any degree that matters. And if this show does one thing, I hope that's one of the things it makes people think about.
I do agree about that. I mean, I think that if you can tell the story right, you can make people think about something they would prefer not to think about. That is good. But somehow this has to be brought home to us and our society, people with money, people with power. And why are we not sort of linking it with that storytelling?
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to switch topics here from the very serious ponderances that you just heard to we don't know what. I'll put it in the framework of my own life. I've already said I got yelled at for even just trying to read this article quietly in bed. But really, even just going down to my mailbox, I'm old-fashioned enough so that certain magazines still get delivered to my house. And so New York Magazine arrived. I pulled it out of the mailbox, and there on the cover were Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. And there's this cover story about these love-struck that word appears on the cover, love-struck news people and their relationship with Donald Trump. And I really almost had trouble walking all the way back up the driveway. I can't read this. It's not going to make me feel better, but I also feel like I can't not read it because it just feels like it's just a really junk food that I'm not going to be able to resist, even though I just know it's going to be awful for me. It's like the synthetic butter at the popcorn in the movies or something like that. So we all read it. I don't think we all feel kind of dirty, I think. I don't know.
You know, I just can't believe this is Brzezinski's daughter and a former representative in Congress. And I fear that Joe and Mika are on their way to being this era's Duke and Duchess of Windsor after the fall.
Mm-hmm. I have made that same analogy, that she is very much the Wallace Simpson of the story. But, I mean, in some ways, James, this is also very much a piece. It's hard to tell how much in control the writer of this piece is. Or even to divine entirely what the writer's attitude towards this is. It's very much a piece about modern narcissism and the enshrinement of it and the fact that narcissists no longer feel that they have to in any way conceal their narcissism.
Exactly. That was my reaction. And so I had this vision of sort of first of all, a public relations firm being hired to clear up this image problem. And then, okay, let's sell this concept. And then they go around the magazines, and what do you know? New York Bit, and they produced this article, which I don't know. I mean, so this is a greatly uncovered story, I think, is how many people hire consultants like this and public relations consultants. And certainly both the network and the individuals have something to gain by having something like that happen. And it's kind of like humanizing people who are behaving in a totally bizarre fashion and actually appearing to facilitate some really awful things, and yet trying to sort of recover and be the intelligent ones amidst this you know, sort of maelstrom of dreck.
You mean somebody paid for this? Why didn't they do a better job?
Maybe they shouldn't get the final check.
Well, I don't want to step on anything you might be getting ready to say.
Well,
here.
This show was basic. I mean, this article was virtually unreadable to me. I started reading it, and then we weren't sure. I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about it, so I stopped. And then when we decided we were talking about it, I just sort of groaned and, like, unhappily forced myself to finish reading it because it is... I mean, it's insane. There are quotes that go on for multiple paragraphs that I have no idea who's talking by the end of them or who they're talking about.
Well, that's because Joe and Mika don't know where one ends and the other picks up. Or that quote's in there, right? They can't tell where the boundaries are between the two of them. Anyway, continue.
And there is, like, the first, you know, I don't know, like, it was probably four paragraphs of this article is about this rabbit that she gives him, and then they're rabbits humping each other just, like, incessantly.
Yeah, what the hell is that about?
I don't know. And I could not imagine. And then he gives the rabbit away because it scratches him. And I was like, who gets scratched by a rabbit? Just clip its nails. And then... I've never seen Morning Joe, and I will never watch it now because I came away just loathing these people and thinking, like, anyone who ever spent any time with Donald Trump voluntarily is probably a monster anyway, so I don't need to know much more about these people.
Well, one of the problems with this article, I'll just wrap this up because we got to get to endorsements anyway. I mean, it sort of conflates two questions. One of them is the highly uninteresting question of their relationship and how it came to be and what form their love takes and to what degree it resembles what rabbits do.
repeatedly.
And then there's this other, and that's their narcissism is all very wrapped up in that. And then there's this other somewhat more pertinent question. To what degree did they come to Donald Trump as fawning coach dogs to try to secure some special place in his court, and then having that not really work out and fall apart, turn into a little bit more of an opposition party and begin picking at him? And I think that if somebody was hired, James, to correct a particular impression, I think that might have been really important to them, and I don't think they got what they wanted. By the end of the article, I'm fairly convinced that that's exactly what happened, that they attempted to ingratiate themselves with this man. They did not behave like actual journalists. And
I think that's absolutely true. The article itself turns out to reveal something they probably really weren't too happy about revealing. And I think that it's a demonstration too of like exactly how unaware do you have to be to realize it's dangerous to befriend somebody like Donald Trump, especially if you're a news person.
I don't know. I'm still trying to get the image of Joe Scarborough's bare glistening ankles. We do wipe from my brain.
Yeah, we do have references to his bare glistening ankles. We are not told what they glisten with. We have to stop right now, and you're probably pretty happy about that. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back.
No, I shout it from the highest hills. I even told the golden last, my heart's an open door. My secret love's no secret anymore.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ryan Priebus. On Monday, we'll be back with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
Before we do endorsements, I do just quickly want to tell you or remind you that on Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Schubert Theater in New Haven, Al Franken and I will be on stage in conversation together. Tickets are available from the Schubert box office. Teresa was just talking about what sorts of behaviors either do or don't make you an a-hole. And I just want to say that my moment, my a-hole moment of the day was saying to my significant other, yeah, we need to be in the car by 1:30 because Al's going to call me then from the road. Yeah. I thought, okay, yeah, Al's going to call you, sure. Because you know Al, right? But it'll be a great event, and please do buy tickets and come. And when you buy a ticket, I think you get a book and I get signed and stuff like that. So I think that's good. All right, time to make some endorsements. Let's start with Teresa.
I had a tough time this week because I've been consuming a lot of frivolous garbage. But one thing
I was worried how that sentence was going to end.
But
amateur porn was like my fear, I think.
But so one thing I've been listening to that I think is worth listening to is a new podcast called Mogul. And it's the story of the life and death of a guy called Chris Lighty, who his sort of story is basically the rise of hip hop. And, you know, you get all these really little interesting insights into that world, the sort of 70s and 80s hip hop scene into the 90s. And then eventually his, you know, rise to superstardom as an agent and then eventually his death. And it's been really fascinating. And you get all these cool interviews with old school hip hop guys.
So Mogul.
It's called Mogul.
All right. I have to keep this moving here for time's sake. James, what have you got?
A couple of books that are giving me a lot of energy amidst the tide of dreck. No Is Not Enough by Naomi Klein. And Nancy McLean, who's a historian, has written a book called Democracy in Chains, which really does go into the far background to find out where a lot of this stuff came from. How did we get where we are now? And one last thing, amidst a week of nasty attacks on LGBTQI and trans people, we're showing a fantastic restoration of Maurice, the film that really was Merchant Ivory's most extraordinary piece that came out at a time when nobody else wanted to fund films. And it has a young Hugh Grant and James Wilby that's running at Sony Studio from today through next Thursday.
Also, Angels in America, Perestroika is running there.
Yes, on Sunday at 1.
Speaking
yes.
of LGBTQI. Anyway, yeah.
All Kate. Right. Well, you just reminded me that Mark Doty and Elaine Miles are going to be at the Sunken Garden Poetry Festival coming up. Also, the James Merrill House Deck Party is happening on Saturday, August 5th. And the Paul Brown Memorial Jazz Concert, Monday Night Free Jazz, continues at Bushnell Park. And last evening, I got a tour of the Swift Factory in the north end of Hartford from a gentleman named Patrick McKenna, and who works for Community Solutions. And it's all about development and people and bringing vibrancy to the North End. And that is CMTYSOLUTIONS.org, Community Solutions. I want to check it out more and learn more about it.
All right, so running out of time here, but I do quickly want to say one of the conversations that we had was about an NPR article about women in pop and the centrality of women in pop and how the canonical understanding of pop and rock and stuff like that could benefit from making women more central to the conversation. I don't really see it. I couldn't figure out a way for us to talk about it. But it made me go back and look at my own, what's on my own title playlist right now. And just like discovering new music. I'm finding all kinds of incredible work by women. I might make a list of them and put them up somewhere. But meanwhile, I think we're going to end with, do we have this? The Macleod Hedero. This is Macleod Hedero and Andrew Bird. It's a song about musical influence. And Macleod Hedero, who on one occasion sat right here in the studio and played for an audience of just me, is amazing.